All right, so we are in, I don't know how I'm going to get out of the way of this. We are in 2 Samuel chapter 1. A couple weeks ago, we did the intro, did the real quick flyby of 1 Samuel, kind of cover that whole story. Remember, 1 Samuel it introduces us to Samuel himself, and that is really Saul's story and Saul's failure as king, and 2 Samuel is David's story. And we're moving into that. And really the whole purpose of the book of Samuel is, I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, is to make sure that we understand that David is not a usurper. Right? That David did not overthrow Saul to get power. That this was God ordained, that David always was above reproach, had every opportunity to take Saul out, and always resisted. All his guys, all his mighty men were saying, take him out. Right, and David continually said, "I will not touch the Lord's anointed," which is going to come into play in this first chapter. And so, with 2 Samuel chapter 1, we're in the aftermath of two battles. If you remember, there was a battle in the south where David was fighting the Amalekites, and he takes the city of Ziklag, way down in the south. I'll show you a map here in a couple slides. While Saul was fighting the Philistines up in the Jezreel Valley at Mount Gilboa. And if you remember how we ended 1 Samuel chapter 31, Saul and his three sons are killed while fleeing from the Philistines on Mount Gilboa. And they find him. The Philistines chop his head off and put it up in their temple and sling his body over the wall at Beit Shan. And valiant men from Jabesh Gilead come in the middle of the night and get the bodies back, Saul and his sons, and give them a proper burial. And so we are 3 days after that. When we pick up chapter 1. And David is way down south, right? He has not heard anything about what's been going on with Saul up in the north. He knows there's a battle that happened. Remember, he went initially to the battle, if you remember that, in chapter 28 or so. He goes up with Achish, king of Gath, to the battle, and the rest of the Philistine kings say, no way, send him back. Right? And David goes back, and he ends up fighting the Amalekites and fulfilling some prophecy there and winning the battle down there at Ziklag. So he's waiting on word about what happened up there. And this messenger is going to show up in chapter 1, and it's a bit of an interesting story. All right, so let's start with our first four verses or so of 2 Samuel. So after the death of Saul, and remember this was all one book at the beginning. There wasn't a 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, so we're just flowing through the story. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead." And then, of course, the big news, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead. Okay? So, again, here's our... And this projector is really not real good this morning. But King Saul's dead. He died battling the Philistines on Mount Gilboa. This is a terrible map, but this is Israel. Okay? This is Israel. Way up here in the north is Mount Gilboa. This is the Jezreel Valley right here. Okay? Here's Mount Gilboa right here on the end of it, right here, but there's a pass that leads down to the Jordan Rift. It's right there, okay? Ziklag is way down here, right on the border of Philistia and Judah, all right? So David is here. The battle took place here. It took 3 days for that servant to get from here down to here, okay? And when he shows up, his clothes are torn. He's got dirt on his head, and here comes this man from Saul's camp, okay? And bad news is assumed here. Why? Look at how he's dressed. If he shows up with torn clothes and dirt on his head, you know what? He's in mourning, right? That's grief. That's an outward sign of that. So the question is, but David doesn't know who this guy is. So when he comes up, he's either coming here mourning Achish, king of Gath, who's lost all his men, or Saul, who's lost all his men. David doesn't know which. But he knows he's struggling because he's got his clothes torn and the dirt on his head. Hey, remember, David has been staying with Achish, king of Gath, and he even initially accompanied him to the battlefield in the Jezreel Valley. He's not sure if the messenger is coming for bad news for Israel or for Philistia. Okay? And the messenger pays homage. He comes up and bows down to King David. Okay? So there's respect shown here. And the messenger describes this military rout, which is exactly what happened. Okay? So The story rings true so far. The entire Israelite army flees from battle. Many are injured or dead, and that's consistent about what we read in 1 Samuel 31. Remember, we said it must have been a total rout of the army because there are no people to come and get Saul's body. Right? That you would never leave your king on the battlefield, you would, because you know what the enemy is going to do to his body, and there's no Israelites to come get Saul. So it is a total obliteration on the battlefield there in the Jezreel Valley. Okay? And then the coup de grace here is that Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead. So when you hear that claim, David has to make sure that this guy's telling the truth. Okay? This is a weighty thing to be said. I mean, think about what this, the range of emotions David's going to go through during the course of this. Right? You've got a guy in Saul that David has professed love for throughout. Right? But Saul has been trying to kill him for many, many years now. Right? And at the same time, he knows he's anointed, he's the next king. So if Saul is dead, that means David is king. Right? So think about all the things that might go through your mind at that point as you hear this. And so he has to figure out if this guy is telling the truth. So he's gonna interview the messenger and probe his story. All right? So verse 5. Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" Verse 6. And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' I answered and said, 'I am an Amalekite,'" which is ironic because that's who David was just fighting. "And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." So, interesting story. Because if you remember from 1 Samuel 31, this was the account we had in the previous chapter, starting in verse 3. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died and his three sons and his armor-bearer and all his men on the same day together. So what's our issue now as we're reading through the book of Samuel? We seem to have contradictory reports.
Right. Right? Credibility is shot.
Yeah, so the question is, what the story that the messenger is telling, can it still be true, right? Can we? What do we do? Can we reconcile this? Do we have a problem? And here's why it's, and there's several examples, right? Well, let me go through and I'll get to that. But he confirms three details here, right? The guy says, "I was there. I was on Mount Gilboa," and he gives an eyewitness account of what he saw. Now, the battle account that he gives is absolutely accurate, right? He says he has a conversation with Saul. Now, that's not recorded in 1 Samuel 31, but does that mean it didn't happen? Not necessarily. And number three, he has tokens from the king. He was there, right? He has Saul's crown and his armlet. He was there. The question is, was he there before Saul died, or did he get there after Saul died? Or is it somewhere in between? All right, I want to look at all that. So let's look at his details, and then we'll look at our options. So detail one, there was Saul leaning on his spear. We know Saul always had a spear with him, right? Remember what he used to do with David when David would play the harp in the room? He tried to throw the spear at him, and it got stuck in the wall, right? So Saul fought with a spear. We know he fights with a spear. We've got stories of that. So it's not like you said, a weapon that Saul didn't have. And the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. That's exactly what 1 Samuel 31 says, okay? That Saul was wounded by the archers, and they were chasing him up Mount Gilboa, and he was about to get caught. Okay. Then he says he had a conversation. He says he walks up, and Saul says, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm an Amalekite." And Saul said to him, "Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers." Okay? And by the Amalekite story, he obeys. He says, "So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen." So he says, this was a mercy killing. "I did this out of compassion. I saw he was in much pain and anguish, and he asked me to do it, so I went ahead and finished the job." Okay? And then again, we've got tokens from the king. The messenger presents David with the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arms. And so these items place the messenger with Saul without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah. There aren't other crowns. There aren't other royal armlets. He's got Saul's royal jewelry. Okay? And there's no way he got that from the Philistines. Okay? He got these off of the body of Saul. Okay? And prior to the Philistines desecrating his body, because they would have taken it. Right? There's no way the Philistines leave the crown and the armlet laying there. They would have taken that with them. Right? So the messenger got these somehow there. So here's our possible explanations. And of course, the liberal scholarship says it's number one, which that's my reaction to number one. Okay? Their contradictory sources were compiled by a redactor. Okay? That's really a stupid argument. When you understand that the book of Samuel was one book, right? It's not like we're combining different things. We've got one book. And so you're telling me that the compiler is so stupid, so inept, that he puts two contradictory stories in back-to-back chapters. They're not even chapters. It's a continuous story. So he's such a terrible redactor, he doesn't realize that 10 lines earlier he just contradicted the thing that he just said. Hey, you've got to paint a really terrible redactor in order to make that happen. There'd be nothing to gain here from a redactor doing this, because it would contradict the story, right? So I think that leaves us with two options. Either the Amalekite is lying, okay, that he's just a thief. He came upon the dead body of Saul, he stole the stuff, and he's coming back to David to ingratiate himself to David and say, look, I know you have been fighting with Saul and you probably hate him, and so I just want you to know he's dead, and here I brought you his crown because you're the rightful king. And he's hoping I'll get something out of this. Or he's relating additional details to the circumstances of Saul's death that we don't hear about in 1 Samuel 31. Okay? And I think both are legitimate possibilities that don't contradict the scripture, and I'll show you that. Okay? So without question, the messenger was with Saul around the time of his death. The crown and the armlet are proof of that. What we must decide is whether he was an active participant in Saul's death or an opportunistic thief who happens upon the recently deceased king. So either, and if you know the story, he's going to be punished in the next section that we read. So either he's being punished legitimately for what he's done, or he's being punished for creating a story that he didn't do. So one of the two. Okay. So my two cents of this, and this I struggled with this all week, right? After trying to come down on a side. I think he's telling the truth. Okay? And I'll kind of try to lay that out to you. I think he came upon Saul after he fell on his sword and Saul was still barely alive. And I think he finishes the job. Although I do still think he's trying to get stuff out of this. I think he's coming to David to get pumped up and get a position. I think that's what's happening. But, and I'll tell you why I think he may have done that. Okay? David never questions the veracity of the messenger's account. Okay? Now, you could say, well, why would he? He's just taking his word for what it is. Okay, that's a possibility, but David never questions it. David never says, that doesn't sound quite right. Okay? He takes it as a real story. I feel like the messenger's story rings true. There's no weird details. There's no wild things in it. I feel like he seems like he's telling the truth. And number three, it explains why the messenger has Saul's crown and armlet. And number four, it makes his execution, that we're going to see in a few minutes, lawful and just. Right? And that's why I think if David is killing him for touching the Lord's anointed, then I think he probably touched the Lord's anointed. I think that's probably what happened. Now, if you want to go the other way and you want to paint him as a thief, that's fine too, because I think it works. Right? Either way, he's with the body. Does that make sense? Y'all following it? It's such a big group and y'all are quiet. So I never know if anybody's just going, this is really boring. Yeah. No, go ahead.
Just in the last chapter of the previous book, it does say in verse 5 that Saul was dead.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Because the way the messenger describes it is he was in anguish. So I know he's wounded already, so I think it can go either way, but yeah, I see what you're saying. It does say he was dead and the armor bearer, but he could have still been barely alive. I don't know. Go ahead.
The author is writing a story, so you want to have some kind of drama in the story, like suspense. And when you watch a movie, sometimes you watch and you'll see a scene and it shows the end, but you miss a little took up scene.
Yeah.
And you'll see it later. A memory or something, you're like, oh, fill in that blank. Thanks.
Yeah, and I think that might be what's happening. Now, again, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we're just talking about how we're reading the story right now. But the other part is the narrator never tells us that he was lying. Yeah, and most of the time, if somebody's not telling the truth, the Bible tells us, he said this, but he really was never there. The narrator never discredits his story. So, but either way, the guy's making a foolish choice. Either he's acted or he's pretended to act in his own interest, and he's going to pay for this life.
But don't you think, too, if this person was not with him as he was other people were kind of watching what was going on, or had to be kind of watching, they may be
Yeah, I don't know how many people are around. I mean, this guy seems like, you know, he says he's a sojourner here in a second. That means he's an immigrant. He lives in Israel. So I don't know if he's just kind of, he's the coward in the battle, and he's just kind of hiding out, and he, you know, comes out after the whole thing's over. But it seems like there are no legitimate Israelites around at all. So it may be fairly isolated.
So you might have discussed this in a different class that I missed, but how did everyone know that David was anointed next? Or, because I know Saul was after him, but Saul was after him because of pride.
Yeah.
Right? He was after him because everyone loved him. But we're looking for an anointed king. Why did they go to David? How did everyone, including a sojourner, a foreigner, know David was next in line? Here's the crown.
Samuel. Because Samuel had, Samuel has a ministry. He anoints David halfway through 1 Samuel. He doesn't die until late in 1 Samuel. And so Samuel was known, well, first of all, you know the battles, right? So there were battle songs that went around. Saul kills his thousands, but David kills his 10,000s. There were stories going on around about David, and I think Samuel's ministry, which in 1 Samuel says Samuel, everybody knew Samuel from Dan to Beersheba, which means from the top of Israel to the bottom of Israel. And so I think in Samuel's ministry, they would have known who David was, in addition to all the things that were going on.
So Samuel was telling people that he anointed David?
Yeah, I think so.
Why would he come in? I was a king, and this guy was a king.
Yeah, well, he doesn't want to touch Samuel. Samuel anointed Saul and everything, too. So there's a... But Samuel comes right out and says, Saul, the Spirit's leaving you. The Lord has rejected you. You're done. You know, he throws the fury at David. But yeah, so, you know, either way. Again, the other point here goes back to the theme I talked about earlier. What would the natural assumption be if it's discovered that David is in possession of Saul's royal jewelry? Right? Like, they're going to think the worst. Like, how come you have that? Right? And so, I think this is showing, look, the story goes out that David has Saul's crown. Well, how did he get Saul's crown? Well, this is how he got it. You know, he didn't go take Saul out. He didn't. There's no foul play involved. This man brought it to him, and that's why he's got it. Okay. So 11 through 16.
Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I'm the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." And David said to him, "How is it you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And I bet you his face changes right there. Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go, execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" The other part of that is, if you were that guy, wouldn't you be like, "I didn't kill him. I was lying. I was lying. I didn't tell the story," you know. But he gets killed for that, and that's what happens. So,
giving you an opportunity to recant. David's got to clear, "Hey, this guy brought me the jewelry. He was there when he died."
Yeah, you've implicated yourself.
End of discussion.
Yeah.
How handy.
That's right. So what's David's reaction? Well, he takes hold of his clothes and he tore them. And not only him, but so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening. All right. So notice he doesn't execute him right away. I mean, the guy probably thinks, all right. But what do we make of this? I think, number one, it shows you that David's love for Saul was sincere. This wasn't lip service. You know, he clearly cared for Saul. He clearly loved Saul, and he clearly loved Jonathan. Right, Jonathan and David are very close, and we talked about this before. Jonathan was probably a good deal older than David was. You know, they're not teenage buddies, which I think is usually how it's portrayed. Jonathan would have been at least 10 or 15 years older, so Jonathan is a mentor of sorts to David. And the fact that Jonathan allies himself with David is a big deal, right? As an older, wiser man, that speaks volumes. Yeah, perfect.
Our greed and our mouth take us to places to go on to, and we can see from
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And yeah, you're not defined by your parents, very clearly. I mean, you've got Jonathan, who is this noble son of a man who doesn't get it. And then you've got, you know, you got things like Eli, who seemed to be a noble guy, and his sons are total dirtbags. You know, like, it just, there's no connection with that. Individuals are accountable. And again, it shows you the type of man that David is, and what he said was real. He tears his clothes and mourns for him. And I would say this is what leadership looks like, because what happens? He tears his clothes and mourns, all his men do the exact same thing. You know, I mean, wouldn't you think there'd be some men in this group going, I hate that dude. You know, like, we've been dealing with him for, he's been trying to kill us, we've been living in caves, but why are we mourning for him? All his men mourn for Saul as well. Now you could say, well, maybe they're mourning a little bit more for Jonathan. Okay, but still, they're mourning for the death of Saul and Jonathan. I mean, that house is now dead. Saul has been wiped away from history, which in an Old Testament Israeli mindset is the worst thing that could happen. Okay? Is that if your name was wiped out, and that's what's just happened to Saul. And so I think it shows you what the men that follow David have the same heart that David does. Right? And number three, he weeps also for the house of Israel, because the defeat at the hands of the Philistines is a national tragedy. It's not like David going, hey, I won my battle down here. My army's doing just fine. That's what happens to Saul's. He mourns for the Israelites that lost their lives in that battle, and the fact that the Philistines are now camped out in the Jezreel Valley in the middle of Israel. Right? That's way up out of their territory. Right? And so from David's mind, in the idea of this is our land, this is the promised land, this is God's land, right? Why did he go kill the Amalekites? Because he has an Old Testament mandate to rid the land of these Canaanites. And now there are Philistines who aren't technically Canaanites, but foreign people that are inhabiting the middle of God's promised land. Right? And so David mourns for that as well. And we'll see David turn his sights on the Philistines here pretty soon, and they'll be done too. Okay? So then the judgment comes. David goes to the Mosaic Law for guidance on what's to be done next. First, David confirms the man's nationality. He says, where do you come from? And he answered, I'm the son of a sojourner and Amalekite. Well, David knows his scripture, and that's probably why he just fought this previous battle. But in Deuteronomy 25, 17 to 19, it says, remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. So there is a divine commandment to wipe the Amalekites out. And so not only did this guy kill Saul, but he's an Amalekite. So he is wide open to be killed here, just like David did in Ziklag in the previous battle. Okay? And David just defeated the Amalekites when he learns that a member of that nation had also played a direct role in the death of Israel's king, the Lord's anointed. David does not hesitate to execute judgment on him. And destroying the Lord's anointed was tantamount to rejecting the Lord. Right? Because that's why David never touches him. Because God said, this is the king. He's been anointed by God's man. So until God tells David, he's not anointed anymore. Right? They didn't say, okay, when David got anointed, Samuel didn't say, you're king today. Right? He anointed him as king, but David had to wait in God's timing to be king. And that's exactly what he's going to do. And so if you go against that idea, which wouldn't you think that'd be kind of tempting? You're David, you're popular, you've been anointed, you know God's brought you out, and I'm kind of ready to be king now, and Saul's kind of a jerk, and he keeps trying to kill me, and yet he has him dead to rights twice, and David doesn't touch him, right? It tells you more and more about who David is, okay? So there's no doubt, that's what I picture the Amalekite doing when he gets there, right? He's excited, he's going to get a reward, and then David says, how is it you are afraid not to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And it goes from happy to sad very quickly. Okay? Everybody needs a Chris Farley gif in the middle of their PowerPoint. It always works. Okay. So David executes judgment. Go and execute him. And he says, your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. So if you want to go with the other side, that the Amalekite is lying, then you can interpret that as David saying, you said it. And if you said it, then you're going to be guilty of it. All right? So again, I'm totally okay with both of those interpretations, because I think they both fit well with what we've got going on in Scripture. And second of all, we know the messenger was with Saul. The crown and the armlet prove that. And his accurate eyewitness account of the battle proves that. But the question is, did he participate in helping Saul finish everything off? Okay? And this is what's called the Lex Talionis. It's the law of retaliation. Okay? And so Leviticus 24, 19 through 21. If anyone injures his neighbor as he has done, it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Whatever injury is given a person shall be given to him. Whoever kills an animal shall make it good, and whoever kills a person shall be put to death. So David uses two instances of the Mosaic Law, one against Amalek specifically, and two, any person that kills a person shall be put to death, and says, and on top of that, you've touched the Lord's anointed. Right? And so the execution is entirely just when he makes that command. Okay? Any thoughts at this point? We're almost done. We're going to be done a little early today. I'd have to look. I'm not sure. Yep.
Can you speak to me about the difference maybe between this situation, you know, where David's not giving this Malachite grace, or something like when, you know, the spies go into Canaan and then there's Rahab and they show grace, you know, and they don't wipe her out. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it goes down to kind of what I mentioned Wednesday night. Rahab is certainly a Canaanite woman, but as soon as she transfers her allegiance to Yahweh, she's in the family, and so I think it changes. Yeah, so all these Canaanite nations have been condemned, right? They are put under the ban. That's what God has told Joshua, and the Israelites are supposed to execute that, and they're supposed to be wiped out. Now, clearly they don't. But I think when Rahab says, I know your God. We've heard about your God. Your God does this, and I want to help you and your God. As soon as she places her allegiance with Yahweh, she ceases to be a Canaanite first. It's kind of like us when we became a citizen of heaven first. Right? Our citizenship changes, and so that means we're no longer under that previous condemnation. Does that make sense?
Yeah. In this case, he doesn't really have much of an opportunity to speak to it, but that's kind of the point, is that if it was important to him, he would have made that connection maybe by now, or his motives are not spiritual, but they're personal.
I think David picks up on that. I think, as David is a precursor of Christ, what does it always say about Jesus when he talked to people? He knew their hearts. Right? And we usually see that, and everybody wants to go, well, that's his omniscience. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I think Jesus was so in tune with people that he could read intentions. You know, and we can do that sometimes too. I mean, you could talk to people and go, the intentions aren't good here. You're smart enough to pick up on that. So just imagine if you're unfallen and you can do that. I think David had a lot of that, and I think he can probably, I mean, he knows this guy's out for something, something else.
And grace, by definition, is unmerited.
Yes.
So him showing this guy, if he showed this guy grace as they showed, it's unmerited. So
right.
It's up to his discretion.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, Anne.
I was just going to say that comparing him to Christ within minutes of being the king, judgment is his first kingly act.
Yeah, that's good. And it's for rejecting the Lord's anointed. How about that? I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Is that why you said that you wanted something? Because if he didn't want something, you would have been offensive.
Yeah, I think perhaps. I think what it tells you is he doesn't have a good handle. I mean, he's definitely not Israelite because he doesn't. Okay, yeah, you hated him. You fought against him, so I killed him. He doesn't understand this idea of the Lord's anointed. And so I think any Israelite would have. Not that they wouldn't have killed him if they were in the same spot, but I think they would have known the gravity of the situation. I think he sees it as, hey, practical. It's like every other nation in the world. You kill the king, somebody else gets to be king, and we move on. But yeah, I think he's ignorant about what exactly he's done in David's eyes. Yes, and even the lowly armor bearer knows you don't do that, right? And I think that's exactly why he doesn't help. Maybe I'm sure he loves Saul, but I think the reason why he doesn't do it is I know what comes with that. Right, and I'm not. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And in that situation, he knows Saul's about to get captured and all this other stuff, and he still won't do it because I'm not going to touch the Lord's anointed, right? So yeah, those are that's good stuff. Anything else y'all see there? I think it's an interesting story. It's an interesting way to start 2 Samuel, that you've got this messenger coming and showing all that. Now, next week, I want to look at the second half of chapter 1, which is David has this lament for Saul and Jonathan. There's a lot of really good references in there, and you see what he's talking about. It really gives us a snapshot of David's mindset after this and as he moves in to be king of Judah. Now, when we get to chapter 2, we'll move into David's kingship. Now, know looking forward that that David was not king over all Israel from day one. He's not accepted by all 12 tribes day one. And so you'll see how that kind of works itself out. So that's probably a good place to end. All right, let's close in a word of prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this time in 2 Samuel and for this interesting story that you've shown us and some of the good discussion that we had here at the end that revealed some other things as well, that judgment comes when you reject the Lord's anointed. That's very true today as well, and I pray that all of us have that faith and knowledge that that is not where we stand. We don't want to stand in rejection of your anointed and your son, and thank you for the grace that he's shown us, and thank you for the salvation that you've given us, Lord. Be with the 1045 service and everything else we've got going on today, Lord. May you get all the glory for it. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, guys.